The rise of rational thought from a culture dominated by myth, religion and storytelling is a subject that's fascinated both ancient and modern scholars. In many ways, the stories told in myths were the first theories put forward about the universe, its creation and indeed the nature of man. They served as very important starting points for the first natural philosophers seeking the answers to the beginning of the universe, as well as for those exploring the nature of the human body and the diseases that could afflict it. Thus, there are some striking parallels between myths and the first theories associated with rational thought. However, the move from irrational to rational ideas is a concept that has presented a problem to modern scholarship. It is very easy to say that with the theories of Thales and his supposedly rational ideas about the universe and its creation, thought shifted from storytelling or mythos to the exposition of a theory or true fact described as logos. But as we shall see, the rise of rational thought from myth is not so clear-cut. This paper aims to show the parallels between the stories put forward in myth and the theories put forward during the rise of rational thought. It will explore both philosophy and medicine, and it will strive to show how the boundaries between myth and rational thought were blurred to a certain extent. The telling of fact and the telling of story came to be regarded as two separate systems of thought, logos and mythos respectively. But it is clear that there was some overlap between the two approaches to thought when the rise of philosophy was beginning. For example, it is interesting to consider the idea that myth was regarded as a form of truth before the rise of philosophy. After all, when a poet such as Homer recited, he invoked a muse, a goddess, to remind him of the story, who served as an unquestionable source. Moreover, the word logos is quite difficult to translate. It not only means the presentation of a fact, but also has connotations of argument or persuasion. Thus, the term logos carries with it the idea that a theory must be criticised and argued with the support of evidence in order to be presented as fact. This approach to thought was essential in philosophy, where only one theory could really be accepted as true through criticism and argument. It is interesting, then, that Herodotus uses the term logos when examining the stories told by Homer. For example, when referring to the stories told about Helen, he favours the account given by the Egyptian priests he meets rather than the account given in Homer's Iliad. The account given by the priest is referred to as a logu, or a true account. However, the account he rejects is also referred to as a logon, despite the admission that Homer probably used the account because he could adapt it to epic poetry, a medium that was regarded in many ways to be opposite to the system of logos. Thus, Homer is using the word logos to refer to two different accounts, whether he believes them to be fact or not. It is clear, then, that logos and mythos were not two completely separate approaches to thought, but overlapped to a certain extent. I will therefore argue, as many scholars have done before me, that the so-called Greek miracle that happened in the 6th century when Thales of Miletus suddenly discovered science and put forward the first rational theory about the universe cannot be a proper reflection of the thought at that time. Unfortunately, none of Thales' work survives, and we rely on fragments of evidence found in the work of later writers and philosophers. One of the most extensive fragments we have is found in Aristotle, who says, and this is figure one on your handout, which should be in your packs, that Thales was the first philosopher and the first to search for an original substance, or her archa, a substance from which everything came to be. He goes on to say that Thales believed that the world was a flat disk resting on a vast body of water, and this water was his archa, or original source. It should be noted here that the account of Thales that Aristotle gives must be read with caution, as Aristotle is writing from a point of view of a philosopher in a time when natural philosophy was an established school of thought. For example, as Kirkraven and Schofield point out, Aristotle is probably describing Thales' use of water in terms of a material cause, a theory that fits well with Aristotle's notion that the early philosophers only used the first of his own four causes. Thales would have presented his theory in a culture dominated by myth, and his ideas about water as an origin of everything may have been very different to what Aristotle seems to think. For example, as Lloyd points out, Thales did not totally reject the gods in his natural theories, but saw his original substance as divine. Thus, the first rational theory may have been more concurrent with myth rather than philosophy as Aristotle knew it. Indeed, there are striking similarities between early creation myths and the theories put forward by Thales. For example, Thales' world model and theory of creation not only has parallels in Greek mythology, but also in ancient Egyptian and Babylonian mythology, and this is figures 2, 3 and 4 on the handout. In the Egyptian creation myth, the god Atum-Ra was the first god to emerge from Nun, the deity associated with primeval water, and he rested on a primeval hillock which also emerged out of none. The Babylonians were another civilization who believed that water was the ultimate origin of the world. This is recorded in their creation myth, the Enuma Elish. In this myth, two forms of water, salt and fresh waters, which are called Tiamat and Apsu, respectively, come together to create gods, who then go on to create the earth, which rests on expanse of water. Thus, in both the Egyptian and Babylonian creation myths, not only does water serve as the origin of all, but there exists a landmass, whether floating or not, surrounded by an expanse of water. The Greek myth of the great river Okeanos surrounding the earth is not dissimilar to these world pictures and may have even stemmed from them. Moreover, Okeanos is also described as the origin of all in the Iliad, and like in the Babylonian and Egyptian creation myths, the primeval water supposedly produced gods who then went on to create the world. It is interesting that in Aristotle's account of Thales' theories, the word Okeanos, meaning ocean, is not used. Instead, udor, or water, is named as the substance that Thales used as his origin of everything. This might be due to the fact that Okeanos and Nun are given names, which shows that they are personal deities, even if they are not anthropomorphic in nature, whereas udor is not a name but a noun that denotes an element rather than a specific body of water. Perhaps Aristotle, by using the word udor, is distancing the role of the divine from the theories of Thales, whom he considers the founder of philosophy. Aside from this, if Thales did use the word udor, he's positing the idea that water is a divine substance, but not any form of personal deity such as Okeanos or Nun. Thus, instead of saying that Thales rejected all anthropomorphic deities, it would probably be better to say that he rejected all personal deities in favour of a divine element that has the power to create all things, as well as the power to support the earth. The divine has thus become part of the natural world, in Thales' theories. This idea that the divine was manifest in a natural entity rather than in an anthropomorphic god is continued in the work of a philosopher who is thought to have come after Thales, Anaximander. Anaximander has a much more complex theory about the beginning of everything, but his theories again have striking parallels to mythology. He theorised that everything was born from to aperon, which literally means boundless or infinite in ancient Greek. This suggests that Anaximander may have envisioned his infinite characterless expanse as the beginning of his universe. The closest parallel to this theory in myth is that of chaos. The use of chaos as an origin of all in myth is an interesting choice, as it is not a visible element like water that can be observed as important to sustain life. Instead, it is a sort of nothingness, a yawning gap or chasm, or just infinite darkness, according to the direct translation of the Greek word. The first creation myth to use chaos in the Greek tradition is Hesiod's version of the Theogony. It is very possible that Hesiod's concept of chaos as an infinite indefinite expanse, which resembles none of the elements on Earth, influenced Anaximander's theory of to aperon. Moreover, according to Aristotle, to aperon is divine, to theon, because it is immortal and indestructible. This is figure 6, sorry. Thus, as in Thales, the divine is still present in Anaximander's theories regarding the creation of the universe. However, with Anaximander, there is also the introduction of opposites. The opposites, fire and air mist, are created from a type of seed that comes from the aperon, and they serve to create the world. The air mist condensing into the earth and the fire surrounding the mist to create the heavenly bodies. Another parallel to Hesiod's Theogony is apparent here, as chaos brings forth earth, Tartarus, Erebus and night, as well as Eros. Earth and night then bring forth their equals and their opposites in the form of heaven and bright air and day, respectively. It has also been suggested that chaos, in bringing about earth, also brought about its opposite, as Gaia is the embodiment of stability and firm ground, whereas chaos is a yawning gap where there is no stable place to rest. Thus, from early myth, it was recognised that the foundation of the universe is based on a series of opposites, such as heaven and earth, night and day, male and female. Anaximander took up this idea that opposites and their interrelation were a vital part of how the universe worked, and in the only extant fragment that we have for Anaximander, which is figure 7, he shows how the opposites are in continuous battle for supremacy. However, a balance is struck when one opposite reaches its maximum limit and has to give way to the other, which then reaches its own maximum limit, and this happens, it recurs. This idea that opposing powers would struggle for supremacy and that some kind of balance had to be struck to preserve order is an idea which is not only very important for the natural world, but also for medicine and the nature of man. Indeed, man was believed to be made up of natural elements, whether these were the elements that made up the natural world, such as earth or fire, or whether they were made up of humours, such as bile or blood. This idea, again, has its foundation in myth. For example, Hesiod tells of how the form of a human being might have been shaped in his Works and Days, when he tells of Pandora's birth. This is figure 8. Here Zeus commands Hephaestus to take earth and water and mould it into the shape of a woman. Moreover, there is a hint in the Iliad that men were thought to be made from earth and water, when Menelaus speaks, ashamed that none of the Greeks have risen to meet Hector's challenge. But may you all become earth and water, he says. The fact that he is implying here that men turn into earth and water when they die suggests that these were the original substances from which they were made. Indeed, rational theories concerning the birth of man and his composition are strikingly similar to these myths. The most similar is the theories held by Xenophanes, who held that all things that come into being and grow are earth and water, that's figure 9, and that includes humans. Moreover, the Hippocratics held similar theories. For example, the author of On Regimen suggests that man is made of fire and water, elements that need to be balanced if a body is to be healthy. Another example of this is the author of On the Nature of Man, who believed that the body was made up of humours which are associated with powers in the natural world, such as the seasons. And this is on figure 11. Thus, earth and water as the origin of man in myth seems to have been the source from which came rational ideas concerning the birth of mankind and the nature of the human body. The elements that made up a human body were considered to be conflicting powers by the Hippocratics, and especially when disease is considered, powers which were once seen to be divine came to be regarded as natural powers manifest in the body. It is interesting that the development in thought from disease being a direct divine retribution to disease being part of a natural world can be seen in the system of myth itself. The best example can be seen in the accounts given of disease in Homer's Iliad and in Hesiod's Works and Days. The idea that man was sometimes punished with disease by the gods for specific injustices is seen in the Iliad when Apollo famously brings the plague to the camps of Greeks for the insult done to his priest. This is figure 12. After 9 days of Apollo attacking the Greek camp with his arrows, the Greeks ask advice from a priest to ascertain the cause of Apollo's anger. This suggests that everyone believes this plague to be a divine vengeance for a wrong, and the matter must be resolved directly with the god who sent it. However, in Hesiod's telling of the first appearance of disease on earth, a blurring of boundaries between the natural world and the divine is present. It is the first woman, Pandora, who opens the jar in which all evils were kept, and diseases are one of the many evils she lets escape into the natural world. This is figure 13. Pandora herself was a menace put on earth by Zeus to plague men in return for Prometheus's gift of fire, which Zeus did not intend men to have. Thus, these evils were released by her according to the will of Zeus as retribution for the gifts given to men by Prometheus. However, the diseases mentioned here could simply be seen as beings that wander the earth from the point when Pandora released them, and they strike men suddenly for no specific reason other than the continuing vengeance of Zeus. In Hesiod, therefore, though diseases are a form of continuing vengeance, they have become part of the natural order of the world in which man must live rather than a direct divine retribution as in the Iliad. So the distinction between whether diseases are divine or natural occurrences is not clear in Hesiod's work. Thus, there was a development in myth from the idea that the gods alone sent disease or illness to the idea that disease is present in the natural world as a non-divine entity. Though later physicians on the whole did not believe disease to be a foreign body attacking man, this shift in ideas from disease being a direct divine retribution to an entity that was part of man's natural environment was an important step forward for rational thought. However, religion and myth still played a large part in the treatment of human beings, and physicians often used a mixture of natural remedies and divine direction, further emphasising the overlap that existed between irrational and rational thought at this time. One of the most striking examples of this idea occurs in the Odyssey. As Odysseus is making his way to Circe's house, Hermes stops him and offers him the antidote to the drug that Circe will no doubt use against Odysseus, as figure 14. Here, Hermes does not simply appear to Odysseus and endow him with the power to overcome Circe, but he provides him with the flower moly, a natural antidote to the drug. This flower is not described as divine or special to the gods in any way. It is merely a dangerous plant for mortals to dig up. Moly, therefore, seems to have certain powers which not only make it dangerous to uproot, but will overcome those in the drug used by Circe. Thus, though there is no mention of how moly should be administered, it resists the drug that Circe uses as its power is stronger. Because this plant seems to be part of the natural world rather than a divine antidote, the implied powers described by Homer echo those residual in the natural world that the pre-Socratics described as we saw earlier. However, the overlap between supplication to a god and the use of natural cures is most markedly seen in the cult of Asclepius. The sick could go to the temple of Asclepius and sleep in the abaton, where the god would visit them in a dream and cure their ailments. The inscriptions at Ephesus, where there is one of the largest temples to Asclepius, do not show Asclepius administering a cure only through his divine power, however. He is also seen to use surgical methods and drugs, methods of healing that you would expect to find in the world of natural healing rather than in the divine world. For example, the story of a woman who was blind in one eye is detailed in an inscription from the Asclepian Epidaurus. This is figure 15. Here the god uses surgery and a drug to cure the half-blind woman in her dream while she sleeps. Moreover, the story of a woman suffering from dropsy is told, this is figure 16. It seems that the cause of the woman's dropsy is considered natural, in that there has been a massive build-up of fluid in her body. This ailment is cured by Asclepius in a dream when he is seen cutting off a woman's head and emptying her of the fluid, a cure that only a god could carry out. When the woman awakes, she finds she is cured of her dropsy. This inscription also shows that theories such as the excess of a natural humour found in the Hippocratic corpus seem to be employed by Asclepius, as all the god does is drain her of the excess fluid. This is a cure that a Hippocratic physician would suggest in order to balance out the powers in her body, though perhaps not by the removal of her head. This similarity to the methods of the Hippocratics is striking. The fact that Asclepius does not simply place his hands on the patient and declare them cured by his divine power, but uses methods such as surgery on the eye or Hippocratic theories such as the excess of a humour, shows that medical theories employed by physicians can sometimes play a part in the divine cure. Thus, the boundaries between what we would consider to be rational medicine and religious practice are not clear-cut here. As we saw above, the Hippocratic physicians often theorised that man was made up of different elements, whether they be elements such as fire or water, or humours such as blood and bile. The elements suggested by the Hippocratics represented certain powers or dunamis within the body, and it was believed that they should all balance in order for health to ensue. An example of this is figure 17. The dominion of one element would bring about a host of diseases associated with that power. These powers at work in the body could be controlled by other powers, such as those residual in food, or exercise, or drugs. We have already seen that the use of drugs in the ancient world and the perception of the effects they have on man go back to the days of Homer in the passage from the Odyssey. The idea that drugs have certain powers is continued in Hippocratic thought, where they are said to purge and control powers in the body. For example, the author of On Regimen 2 talks of the various powers manifest in the seeds of plants, such as the cucumber plant, and in plants themselves, such as the poppy or the lupin. For example, he states that lupins are in their nature strengthening and heating, but by preparation they become more light and cooling than they are naturally and pass by stool. This is figure 18. While their powers could be observed in the effects they had on a patient, the healing properties in relation to balancing the powers in the body probably had varied results. To conclude then, the rise of rational thought was not a straightforward phenomenon in either philosophy or medicine. Concepts of powers manifest in the natural world and in the body arose gradually from earlier theories posited in myth about the nature of the divine and the role it played in the natural world. The concept of disease and the practice of medicine, even in religion, was tightly bound to the idea that natural powers existed in the body and needed to be balanced. This idea was very much akin to the theories of the pre-Socratic philosophers regarding powers in the natural world. Therefore, as in natural philosophy, the nature of this thought concerning different powers within the human body indicates a shift away from belief in divine power bound up with the will of the gods, towards the powers manifest in the natural world and in man. Thank you. Oh, thank you.